Okay, today is December 5th, and we are on page 4 in the Chuvaret, and what I'd like to do is interpret these midrashim that speak of a certain destiny that Moshe seems to have from very early on that he's not getting into the land of Israel. What do these midrashim mean? Okay. I want to give you two examples before we start of what I intend to do with these midrashim, page 4 in the Chuvaret. I'm going to give you two examples of what I mean to do with this. Okay. Okay. One is related to Moshe himself. You have three stories introducing him to the burning bush, where the three stories seem to have something in common. They're people who have a conflict, right? Moshe seems to be growing in each conflict, right? And the three conflicts, let's call X the Hebrew and Y the non-Hebrew, right? So in the first story, you have an Ish Ivri is being beaten by an Ish Mitzri, right? The next story, you have two Ivrim. And the next story, you have two non-Ivrims. Every possible combination of Ivri and non-Ivri situation. Okay? So if you recall, what we did then is that we compared the three and the success of Moshe in each one as a harbinger or a sort of like Masav of Simon Levanim that Ramban often does in Bereishis, as a template or a setting the stage of how he would do when it came to standing up to anybody, when it came, even God perhaps, when it came to protecting his people, right? Dealing directly with his people, or dealing just totally klapei chutz, maybe with a Sichon or Nog or a Paro or a Molech or something like that. So the problem is in the second story, where he doesn't even seem to get his objective, right? One has to imagine that Aharon might have been more successful at dealing with the second story, even the Midrashim we know about how Aharon dealt with these kind of things, right? So, but this is the example. I used three such cases to exemplify the future events in Moshe's life. Okay? We did this on the, if you recall, on the heels of Robert Alter's introduction to his The Art of Biblical Narrative, where he spoke of the three wells in the Torah, Rivka, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Rachel, Tzipora, Moshe, where the role played by the woman is indicative of her future role. Yeah? Okay? So it's as if though there's like a certain goral, if you will, a certain destiny that's being played out by these stories, an ironic destiny. If you respond to Ayeka by shifting your blame onto someone else, don't be surprised if you have a son one day who hears Ehevelochicha, right? And he also shifts blame onto something else rather than, you know, breaking down to God and saying, I don't know what I did to my brother, he's not moving, whatever, right? Okay, so I told you I'd give you two examples. I think another example of this is, if you will, with grandfather, father, and grandson, these three characters, David, Shlomo, and Rechavam, who sort of play out a particular destiny that seems to be laid out for them. The reader has to say, how did they let this happen? How did this happen? And you say, I'll tell you why it happened. It could be for a minor event, but the fact is that I'm going to coin a term here. I never saw it written in any book, but David is extremely successful in whatever he does. It doesn't mean he's without danger. His life is on the line all the time, and it manifests itself with many prakim and tehillim, especially between chapter 50 and 60, about events during the reign of Shaul. David may have great faith that he will survive all these great dangers because God promised him and crowned him king already. You know, a faithful person can say, God, you crowned me king, so why am I running for my life each and every day? Right? He doesn't say, make my day shuffle, God told me I'm going to be king, so what are you going to do? Kid. Right? So David, you know, strategizes how to survive. And things go very well for him. You can see when he convinced Shaul for the job of giant slayer, right? He knew he was destined for something great. Remember the story? Right? The bear and the lion and okay? So when he kills Goliath, he did, but you know, it's fraught with danger, it's fraught with problems. And Shmuel Bet, after he becomes the undisputed king, he's successful, whatever he does. You should read the reports in Divrei Hayomim about this. Extremely successful. He wins every single battle, just unequivocally, without any obstruction. His greatest defeat was of the Philistines in chapter 5, and God gives him all the insider information. Don't go that way, you'll lose the war if you go that way. You got to turn around and surround them from the other way, and they don't know that, so you're in the way. All right, David is wildly successful at whatever he does until he arranges to lose a battle. And then everything falls away. Go to that, Shmuel Bet, Eric, you also do Bet. And then his whole life is a response to that event. After the story with Bathsheba and Bathsheba, everything that happens to him is because of Natan's rebuke of the story. It's almost like everything that happens to Yaakov after last week's parsha somehow ironically reminds him of that unfortunate day where his mother convinced him to take the bracha. If you asked him afterwards, and he asked me, I'd say, you still have to take the bracha, because your mother wants you to, and she's very convincing, and you should do it. But not everything we do is 100%. Some things we do is 80-20, some things we do is 60-40, some things we do are 51-49, and you still got to do it. But that 49 is going to come back to you for the rest of Bereishis. Right? You're going to fall in love with a younger sister, and you're going to get the older sister. And you're going to look at her in the morning and say, how could you do this to your sister? She's been waiting to marry me. What did you do to her? He goes, yeah, you didn't do this something like this to your brother? And then he goes to his father-in-law and says, what are you doing to me? Lo mi bi soni. Lo yoseki nibkomei, lo sei satsir b'fnei elochira. It's just that Yaakov is reminded again and again that although it was the right thing to do, but sometimes the right thing to do has some wrong in it, and there's going to be punishment. Right? I don't mean to say that what David did with Bathsheba was the right thing to do, but in this case, both Shmuel Bet and Bereishis Bereishis is that these are all these ironies that happen at the end. And it's not ironic in Shmuel Bet, it's just that it's what the prophet said would happen to him. Okay? That's the way the Torah works. So there's no possibility in Parshas Toldos where it says, and the thing was evil in the eyes of God that Yaakov deceived his father. Right? The Chor Shor says it was Esau who was deceiving his father. Explain to me.
Oh, because he did all these things that were not...
That's trash.
Because once he sold the Bechor, then
he should have told his father that day ahead. I'm so sorry, I hate to disappoint you. But I never expected to outlive you anyway. And I sold whatever you think the Bechor is. It's not mine. It's his. Right? Like that. Okay? How can we just dutifully listening to his mother saying, right? Okay, and when Esav, who I don't know if he probably didn't inform his father, he tricked me twice. Now I see why his name is Yaakov. He goes, twice? When did he do something like this before? He goes, well, when we were younger. What do you mean? What did you do? He goes, I sold, Gambaruchi. Yeah, okay. Come on. Why didn't you tell me that before you went out? I could have saved some anguish here. Right? Okay, so Shmuel Bet, you with me? Well, this is a term I coined when I used to teach Shmuel, is that after the story of Bathsheba, David goes through a process called the Shaulization of David. He starts to behave like Shaul. What is that? What does it mean to behave like Shaul? I know this is so many tangents, that this is so crucial. At the end of Parshas Balak, Bilam sees, I can't get at the Jews with my curse. So, and it's mashma, and what I'm about to tell you is not in Parshas Balak. Ibn Ezra says that Parshas Balak keeps this out of our mind because we shouldn't blame what happened there on Bilam. It's in Parshas Matos when it says that they killed Bilam al Dvar Peor. It's very Parshat. Question is not how do we know that Bilam was behind that stuff there. Question is why doesn't Parshas Balak say it there? Because we shouldn't blame it on Bilam. He goes with the son, he got the women, but it's our fault. So what's happening? The Midianite women are parading around with their, and taking away all these Jewish men. And one of the leaders is copulating right in front of the old Moab. Come on, they're friendly women. Let's go. Let's just have some good time here. Everybody does this. This is what they do in the temples. Our God is boring. He keeps us from so much enjoyment and fun. What kind of religion is this? And everybody is. What are we going to do? Why doesn't Moshe do something there? Why is his nephew Pinchas has to do something? It's not his grandnephew. Right? Elazar is his nephew. It says his nephew's son gets up and does something. Why not Moshe? You think? Oh, is he dumbfounded? It's an important lesson here. Right? Someone's got to stand up and do something about where are these women from? Midian. Moshe is a little, his hands are tied about this. Why?
His wife is from Midian.
Now Moshe would have an answer. Why would she mention this? No, the question. Because if Moshe had stepped forward and said, guys, we don't do this kind of thing. Sex is for your private bedroom, not for an open forum in a temple like the guys do. Right? So if Moshe stepped forward, he'd be right doing so, of course, but then someone would say, oh yeah, new, and who is Matir, you are Midianite? Right? And Moshe would have an answer. He'd say, oh, fine, it was before Mount Torah, there was nothing talking about. But still, be careful, you have to be beyond reproach in any way, when or you very clearly explain yourself, right? So what does Pinchas do? You all know that's how we know that they were engaged in it, but he skewers them. Right? He kills two people with one thrust, and then Hashem rewards him for this type of behavior. No due process, no court case. Right? He just frightens everyone out of this, and the ketzef ends, and we're finished. And then Hashem gives Pinchas, receive shalom. Given him a covenant of peace. Now, in Pashup Shat, Mistama, we already know that the Kohanim have a covenant of peace. Earlier in Bamidbar, it says, V'yaseh Melech HaShalom, that's their job. Right? The Kohanim are purveyors of peace. But then the Tziv says something much more grand, and that's what we're going to come back now to mention. And the Tziv says that no matter what was motivating Pinchas. Okay, it was love, it was hope, it was whatever was motivated. It's inconceivable that he should not suffer some kind of mental jarring of his mental equilibrium, if you will, by doing this violent act. You know what I'm saying? You put figure out the biggest evil you could think of. Put a couple of ISIS men who were just about to to plan a terrorist attack. Parenthetically, Israel just foiled a big ISIS attack that they were planning for Yom HaTzmaut in Yerushalayim. Like something, I mean, like 9/11 level. Right? So they're out there, and they're trying to do so every day. Right? So if you had those guys, if you have any trouble, you know, giving them some serious, but still, no matter what, no matter how much the evil, no matter how, by doing something like this, you're going to suffer perhaps a moral collapse. Especially if you have a conscience. Right? The Brisi Shalom is to protect Pinchas from that. Now, there was an article by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein on this that why does Shaul lose his kingdom over Amalek but not killing off every last Amalekite? So that one king, a couple of sheep, come on, that's what you lose a kingdom over? Not Bathsheba and sending a man among 50 others to die in battle, but at a suicide mission, but not, but what was with that? Right? So then there were a lot of answers to that, not least of which is an inability to confront wrongdoing is what makes a sin remain. Doesn't it chatasi immediately? Even as it may. Shaul is killed not because Shaul is branded not because he didn't kill the king. This is what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein said. He said that he was branded because he killed everybody else. He was commanded to kill everybody else. Yeah.
Once he's not killing everyone, then he's not fulfilling the command, and therefore he shouldn't kill anyone.
Correct. Or why did the king alive? Because I want a king's ransom. Or let him watch what I'm doing to his people. Either way, he's killing for sadism, he's killing for personal gain. Once there's something more, I know, look, it's a different world then. And what can I say? I understand even Shmuel Aleph through the lens of a halachic approach, which says that Amalek always has the chance. There's no war we ever fight, not against the seven nations, not against Amalek, where we tell them a chance. Listen, this is what you did to my people back in Parshas Bishalach. Are you ready to change and all we ask is a peace treaty. You know, B'nai Bonav Shal Hamal Vim Dutorba B'nai Bar. Amalek is allowed to convert. Only Amal and Moav can't, the males. And that's a special reason to have to deal with another time. I think we once talked about that here in this class. Remember with Elisha and the bears and the 42 bears? Remember that? The 42 children, right? Okay. So that if Amalek says no, we're Amalek, we're not going to stop hating you. All right, so okay, I'm sorry, I have a command. It's the last time we ever did such a thing to Amalek. Right? So I have this command, this is what I'm going to do. You ready? You still want to do it? Yeah, go on, bring it on, man. Let's fight. Okay? So, you're correct, by leaving the sheep or by leaving the king, and it shows that you're doing this for some kind of personal gain or some kind of, then you're not doing it limits, chain limits, but then each and every life you took from Amalek is a sin. Okay? And Shaul does not have the protection that Pinchas had. He has to live with himself with this. The Netziv says this also by the destruction of an ear hanidachas. Parshas Re'eh, you all know what I'm talking about? You all know what the Yerid Dachas is, right? He says that after the destruction of the Yerid Dachas, the Torah says, and I will give you rachamim. Really? You give me rachamim because I just destroy the whole city without rachamim? Right? The answer is, after you destroy a whole city, I mean, who knows what's in that city? All right, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, the name Perek, says there's no such thing as Yerid Dachas, but still, it's in there. Right? I just did something very cruel, and now you're giving me a bracha rachamim so that the cruel act that I did, hopefully the Shem Shemayim, doesn't make me Shaul. You get that? I submit to you, let me see what you, just instead of the Enfield. Why did Yondu get to build a base of impression? Quote to me, David offers to build a base of impression. Shmuel Bet Perek Zion. What was the stated reason in Shmuel Bet Perek Zion? I've never met someone who gets this answer right the first time. Never. Let me see if one of you can. What was the stated reason why the prophet tells him you can't build the base of English? Shmuel Bet.
Because the son is better. The son is more deserving.
Okay, you want to give me the right answer now?
Does he say not you, and the next day he says why?
Yeah, okay, you're almost right. He doesn't tell him why he can't build the base of English. He doesn't tell him. Whatever. Most people will say, you're a man of war, you killed a lot of people, you're a man of war. There are three different reasons given in Divrei HaYamim for why he couldn't build the base of Mikdash. All like that. But not in Shmuel Bet. In fact, Mendy's correct. When David said, you're almost right. When David said, I'd like to build God a house. Look, I'm sitting in a window. In a palace in the Beit HaRazim, and God is still behind the curtain, like in Moshe's time. I'd like to build God a house. Natan's initial response?
Didn't say yes.
Yes! This is a great idea! Go and do it! You will succeed. Whatever you do succeeds. And one could not fault David for being a little upset when the king comes, when the prophet comes the next morning and says, David, I have bad news for you. You can't do this. Doesn't give a reason. And by the way, David doesn't ask. David is very magnanimous in that chapter. You know, you can say, "Come on, I'm not giving you a stipend, buddy. I'm paying for your kollel, whatever David the king expects from his top prophet, right? How did you get that wrong? Okay." And then, why does only Divrei HaYamim mention the reason? You shed a lot of blood, you're a man of war, the one who builds the Beis Hamikdash has to be a man of peace, hence his name, Shlomo. That's why maybe Avshalom thought, hey, it must be me, I'm born ready. Shlomo wasn't even born at the time. Right? So, this is amazing. Why did the prophet get it wrong? Right? And why doesn't he tell him? I can't answer to you why he's done it so magnanimous. The Gemara just says in Sanhedrin, a man is never jealous of his son's accomplishments. You tell me I'm not going to do something I dream to do, but my son will? I'm happier. Right? I'm not going to win the Israel Prize, my son will? Beautiful. If you really want to see an amazing Israeli film on this very topic, it's called Footnote. You will love it. It's a film about a father and a son who both are scholars in Israel. And the son is supposed to get the Israel Prize, but the guy calling accidentally tells the father he's going to win the prize. And the whole rest of it is how to navigate this problem of who should actually get the prize and how to tell the father that it's not yours, it's your son's. It's all Hebrew. It's great. I saw it in the theater. Called Footnote, Hebrew speaking with English subtitles. Very entertaining. Okay, but in this movie does not, excuse me, I'm going to spoiler now, but this movie does not follow this. The father is very jealous that his son is getting what he feels he deserves. Okay? Full disclosure, he doesn't deserve it. The son was supposed to get it. It's just called the father by accident, same last name. All right, anyway. So David is magnanimous because, it's not me, it's my son. Fine. But what's the psul? Because you fought a lot of wars, is that a psul for building the Mishmikdash? Why should it be? If you hear about this halacha, I mean, it says so, it's safe and beloved. No metal instruments go into the harabais. You want to cut stone, you got to cut it at the mountain or cut it outside. No metal sound on the Har HaBayis. Does it sound familiar from the Torah? Doesn't it sound familiar with Parshas? Yeah, Parshas Yisro. Remember it says in the Mikneh Mizbeach, don't cut it with Garzen. Garzen shortens life, Mizbeach elongates life. Don't mix those two. There's a Shabbos table minhag that comes from this. You know? That you put away the knives for benching. Because your table is the Mizbeach, and benching is the Korbanos. The eating is the Korbanos, but at benching, you can't take away the knives when you're eating. What are you going to cut your meat with? Right? But at benching, you take away the knives. It's not just because once in the Gemara, someone was so distraught that B'nai Yerushalayim took a knife and stabbed himself. But, alright, that's a separate brachah. I ain't sure. So, here's the impact for our story, is that David is magnanimous when he hears why he should be. So I will just tell you this, it's a philosophical chiddush by Bravanel. The reason why the prophet didn't know why David couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash is because the psul in David not building the Beis HaMikdash hasn't happened yet. Hear that again? Is fighting battles, is fighting a war a psul in whatever we, there's peace that the Beis HaMikdash represents, has to be built by a man of peace, has to be built by a man not distracted by wars. It's the order. First you get rid of a Amalek. I'm sorry. First you appoint a king, get rid of a Amalek, and then build a Beis HaMikdash. You can't build a Beis HaMikdash with a Amalek around. Okay? I mean, there's a halacha like this. You know, if you didn't come on in here, you know, chas v'shalom, if you run over someone and kill them, right, the Shulchan Aruch says you can't do it for the rest of your life. Even if you ran right in front of your car, And you made good breaks, and you made good reflexes. In other words, it wasn't your fault at all. Right? The Ramah says there's tshuva. You could take a driving safety course. You can show that I'm really working hard at this. Right? Because a Kohen who says, you know, say, Lev Shalom, if you ever in your life took a life, sorry, okay, you're going to have Pinchas' problem, right, without the Brisi Shalom. Right? You're a descendant of Pinchas, but still. Alright. But here's the funny thing. If someone, let's say, is in an Israeli war, right? Kohen is on Miluim, and the camp is infiltrated from the he's right at the border of Lebanon. And some Hezbollah come over and he has to save his friend. He's about to, and he actually takes the guy by his hands and violently slits his head off with his knife, right? And he saves everybody. They do it, make a report of everything. And a half hour later, his minion. They have a minion. You know, the guys are davening there. Like you've maybe seen from Yom Kippur War. They had their lulav and his rogim, and they're davening. And he's a kohen. It's time to duchen. What do you say, duchen or not? I mean, I would think slicing someone's head off with this, you know, those nice knives they have is much more violent than hitting a kid with a car where you can justify it. He ran right in front. But the second guy gets the door. Half hour later. Tell me the difference. Yeah.
Self-preservation.
Is necessary. Yeah, that's sort of the answer that comes before or after, because he's a mitzvah. He's saving his friend, he's saving colleagues trouble. This guy wants to come over and bomb that yeshuv over there. He's a mitzvah. You can't stop someone from duchening because he did something violent in the process of doing a mitzvah. So the question is, does someone who killed in battle get disqualified from duchening or from... No. David is not disqualified from building the Beis HaMikdash because he fought battles and fought wars for God. No. The blood that he spilled that disqualified him was not known to this prophet because David hadn't done it yet. Only God knows the future of that when it comes to free will. The prophet does not. The Bravanel says, it's amazing, amazing tradition. says that had Gubbin exercised his free will to turn away from this woman he saw bathing from his pet, from his porch, right? You know what I'm talking about, in Shmuel Bey's Perikin Aleph. Or he exercised his free will to deal with it afterwards in some other way besides sending this man to his death together with 50 other men. Then the prophet would have come over the next morning and said, you know, David, I have good news for you. You can do this. You know, God says something, sometimes something you don't like, and you can't build the basement of the head. And then you do great shuba, you acted very good, I don't know. David practically built the Beis HaMikdash. He set up everything in Divrei Yomim for Shlomo. Right? Read the last 7 chapters of Divrei Yomim Aleph, and you'll be convinced. Right? A lot of the daily davening comes from David's prayers when just mamash setting up the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Right after Yishtabach for Ashkenazim, and the Yom David right before Yoshe. Okay, so Lamaisa, it's a big finish. That was prevented David from building the Beis HaMikdash in chapter 7 is because of something he did later in chapter 11 and 12. Chapter 11. Okay? So that's why the prophet didn't know about it. As far as the prophet's concerned, nothing David did within all those wars should disqualify him from building the Mikdash. Okay, got it? So what's this thing between these 3 generations? Is that after Shaul wiped out Amalek for the wrong reason, he becomes what Pinchas would have become if he didn't get a Rishi Shaul. He would have become what the people in the Nir HaNidachas would have become if they didn't get the Bracha Brachim. And he becomes the Shaul we know, who is violent, does everything the opposite of what you hope someone should do. You're reading his story and you say, don't do that! That's what David becomes after Bathsheba. I call it the Shaulization of David. Everything he does from then on, the reader, if you're really reading carefully in Shmuel Bet, the reader is saying, no, Siva is lying, no, don't do that. No, but Mephibosheth is that, that's what you're doing. It reaches its crescendo when David screams out when Avshalom is killed, Avshalom b'ni me tain b'ni chumim, you know what I'm talking about, right? If only I could take your place. And then Yoav has to rebuke him. He said, why are you making enemies of your friends and friends of your enemies? If you were alive today, all these tens of thousands of people who followed you across the Yarden would be dead. Is that what you want? Mourn for your son in private. Yoav's right. So, but does everyone, can everyone tell me now, why does David suffer? Why does David become Shaul? Because he has a conscience. And he has to live with himself that he sent this man to this untimely death together with 50 other men in the suicide mission. Now, a king does have the right to try out a suicide mission, but we know what his intention was. What I mean by, you know, against all odds. Right. Now they make movies about that from World War II, you know, Dirty Dozen and stuff like, you know. No one ever thought that they would succeed, but they did. Right. So where does Shlomo come in on that? Okay, but I have to say one more thing. After the battle, someone named you know which Mobet that David supported Yonatan's son, Mephibosheth, he was crippled. He gave him a house, he gave him a staff, he gave him a staff of 35 men looking after his needs. Imagine 35 servants for one person. A man named Siva, with his 15 sons, and a staff of additional 20 men to see to every need of this son of Yonatan, my best friend. During the war with Avshalom, during the rebellion of Avshalom, this Siva came to David and said, no, Mephibosheth remained in Yerushalayim and was hoping you would die and kill your son, that you would both die in battle, and then the king Melucha will go back to Binyamin. He's the only surviving descendant of Shaul. He was hoping you would die so that he would be able to go back to you. He said that? You kind of see Shabbos Nachman Hay, which goes through hoops to show that whatever David did with Bathsheba was allowed and didn't violate any Torah law. But on this, the Gemara admits, Kibel Lo Shekara. He lost his kingdom for that. How did he lose his kingdom? Because he told Siva, all the property I gave to Mephibosheth is yours. That's the whole, that's from the central bus station all the way up to Harper's. Can you picture this? Right? Harper's all up there, right? All the way up to like Yad Vashem. So he says, two words to see them. So then after the war, Mephibosheth finally makes his way to David and says, David, Siva was lying about me. I remained in Yerushalayim because I'm crippled. It doesn't mean that I supported Avshalom. And he said, get out of my sight. I already decided what to do about your fate. Split it. What's the irony? What heavenly voice comes out when David says, split the field, you with Avshalom.
Split the kingdom.
When was this so? You could just so flippantly, so impetuously just say, okay, you take all of it. No, it's mine. It's what you do. It's my father's. No, okay, that's what we call that area. You know what it's called today? What's that area called, guys? Kibbutz Shaul. Right? South of London? It's much closer to the central bus station. It's called Kibbutz Shaul. The name changes. Now, did you guys play yeshiva in that area? No? I went to BFT, which is just a block. All right, so where Torah Tragen is. Okay, so Shlomo does something similar. He makes a room full of gasping people think that he's actually going to cut a baby in half. And truth be told, there's a lot of ancient stories like that too, where someone is ready to cut something in half to prove it's a true owner, right? Okay. So when Shlomo says cut the baby in half, that impetuosity, even for good intention, I'm sorry, that's too much. That story is a haftorah, very rarely read. Maybe in your lifetime, three or four times it's been read. Because the parsha it is the haftorah of is almost always preempted by Hanukkah. But it's the story of Yosef putting his brothers through the mill to get them all down so he could sort of, you know, cleanse them of what they did to him. We're going to talk about what Pasha would that be.
Mikates.
Right? It's the Torah of Mikates, which Shlomo was ready to cut the baby in half. What's the connection? Is it a dream in both? That's not enough. Lots of dreams. You know, enough dreams that you can take them other places in the baby. The connection is that both Shlomo and Yosef overstep the bounds of what a leader should do. You get it? They go too far. Yosef, you should have gotten in touch with your father and tell him where you are. Right? And Shlomo goes too far. And therefore, Shlomo's kingdom gets cut in half. And Yosef loses out to be the malchus to the one who challenges him. You hear? So what's the like father, like son, like grandson? Is that when Rechavam is presented with lighten up on the taxes, lighten up on our burdens, and we'll serve you like we served your father and grandfather. So what idiot would not go along with that? He takes advice from elders, the elders of Israel. Remember? And they say, of course you should lighten up on that. Just take it easy now. And then afterwards you can bring it back. And then he asks advice. This is so crazy. He asks advice after he asks the Zakenim, the book that's not called them, Yiladim. Yiladim, he's 41 years old. Yiladim or 10. He asks the advice of Yiladim. It's as if the Tanakh is darshing. You know, they gave childish advice. I know what it means. It means these are kids he grew up with. You get it? They're his age, but the Tanakh calls them Yelodim. And they said, you stand up to them. You call their bluff. You have an army. They can't. You stand up to them. Don't put up with that. If you lighten up on taxes, you'll never hear the end of it. And of course, he takes the second advice, and it's all for God. And Yerubbaal ben Nebat splits the kingdom. Split the field. Split the baby. Split the kingdom. All this was the introduction, 5 minutes left, to why did Moshe not get into the land of Israel? So we all know why. It says someone said in Parshas Chukas, right? Okay, we did this a while ago. Okay, you had a chance. It was a very teachable moment. About what you do when you don't have water. You learn Seches Taimis, and you have a fast, and you call up to God, you say Tehillim, right? Instead, God told you to take a stick in your hand to talk to the rock. You use your mouth when you don't have rain. And Moshe says, God, that was a setup. Why did you tell me to take the stick? Because back in Bashalach, I took a stick, and I hit the rock. You didn't say anything was wrong then. I know, Moshe, that was the beginning of the 40 years in the desert. This is the end of the 40 years in the desert. And I want you to teach them. Things are different than we're about to go into the land. Rosh Chukas starts off Rosh Chodesh Nisan of the second year, right? And then it says, Vayomos Mary. Thomas Mary. That's the 40th year. Right? Chapter 19, from the last pasuk in chapter 18 to chapter 19, 38 years of nothing. So God says, listen, Moshe, it's a teachable moment here, and you didn't teach it, so that's that you lost the chance to Mekadesh Hashem, and it showed a lack of emunah. But we did all that. We did the 13 different reasons of all the things that Shaddai brings down in Moshe, what Moshe did wrong in that story. And then he says, they're all wrong. I go with Rashi. He should have talked, and instead he did. Right? So, why is it that on page 4, Bamid Barchof is there, right? Okay, why is it that Rashi, I'm just going to do Rashi, it's all in Shmos Rabbah, says that when the first time, when Moshe said to God, Shlach na biyad tishlach, the pshat is simple, send now in the hands of the tishlach, the one you usually send. In other words, God, if you're talking to me at this bush, I don't believe I'm the first person you've ever talked to. Surely you have other messengers. I'm not your best guy. Simple shit. Instead, what does Rashi write? He says, God, I'm not destined to take them into the land of Israel. Shlach no, send now for Yetzias Mitzrayim in the hands of a person that you can send to be Knesa La'aretz. Since that's not going to be me, I don't want to do this. Okay? A lot of people have misread what Rashi says here, because... but I'm just going to point out that in the real pshat, it seems that he's saying, send Aaron, don't send me. Send someone who's in Egypt. Right? The reason I think why Rashi brings down this pshat, this drash, I should say, is because it captures the word tishlach better. Right? According to the pshat, it's send now the one that you usually send. According to the drash, it's send now to do this mission, to take them out of Egypt, in the hands of the one that you are destined to send, tishlach, and lashon latid, in future, the one you're going to send to take them into the land. You have two children, man. It seems from Moshe's objections, he did this in the very beginning of his ministry, that Moshe's objections is that he's worried what Aharon is going to think if your younger brother, Johnny, come lately, after all these years, he's been away 40, 60 years, they're 80 now, 80 and 83, right? Moshe was considerably younger, Mistama, when he ate the Egyptian. And who's this guy out of nowhere, right? Not a single lash on his back ever, maybe that one day, but he moved his Mistama, the symbol of Sam, I don't know. But, okay, that's one. Right? Two is when Moshe complained a lot at the end of Shmos, why you made life worse for them since I came? And they put a sword in Paro's hand to kill them. So Hashem says, Atotireh, now you'll see what I'm going to do to the Egyptians. And Rashi writes, again from Shmos Rabbah, but you won't see what I'm going to do to the 31 kings, because you're not getting it to Israel, because you complain too much. Three. Kriyas Yamsuf, Moshe says, to be emo, resito emo bahar nachalosko. What does that mean? It's a poetic form of to be ahem, resito ahem. Take them and plant them in the land of Israel, God. Why not to be enu? Where to be enu? To be enu, resito enu, take us. Rashi writes, Moshe already knew he wasn't going into the land of Israel. So what we're going to do next class is deal with, we have to deal with Rashi, because look at the first source on page 4. Rashi says that when Moshe tells Yisro in Parshas Balosva, which by every measure is after these briefs of him, everything in Bamidbar is after everything in Shmos. Except the Bechor Shor says some of the events are actually the same event. Fair enough. But when Moshe asks Yisro to stay with us in the desert, right, that's definitely after all three of these. Of course. So when Moshe tells Yisrael, come with us, we, no simanachnu, elamakom asher omar Hashem oso atein lochem, directly contradicting Rashi on 3, right? And Rashi writes, Adayin, right? Adayin lo nigzero gzero alav, because of Moshe, who nichnas? Moshe hadn't hit the rock yet. And Moshe thought he's coming into Israel with everybody else. Ash, how does that work? Instead, you should say something like what Rashi says when Avram told his lads, we're going up to the mountain to serve God, we will return. I think he meant it. But Rashi says he was lying because he didn't want to say, we're going to go up to the mountain, we're going to slaughter my son and burn him. He would say, no, don't do that. And so Moshe said, you start with the shul. So Moshe's saying, we're going in, because he's not going to tell them, by the way, you guys are going in, but I'm not, because I know I'm destined. No, he really thinks it's Parshas Balosva, then he's going in. Okay? Okay, there are two other things Moshe does in the Torah, I'll get to them next class, that, amazingly, Rashi's one of them, the other one is a medrash I have to talk to you about. For why Moshe doesn't get into Israel. Two other things he does in the Torah. Of course, before he hits the rock. Once he hits the rock, all bets are off. But two other things Moshe does, and I'm going to tie it all in. What do all these have in common about the way Moshe is talking or the way he's hearing that sort of deals with like the goral? You see a goral there for cutting the kingdom in half? Right? To David, Shlomo, and Rechavim? There's a goral that sets in with Moshe. Right? Okay, let's have a great day today.